Great to have you along on the Ideas Network as we take a look at physical therapy today. It's an invaluable thing for people, helps them deal with injuries and other physical issues, and we're going to be talking about some various methods physical therapists use and explain what they're most effective for. And talk with a couple of guests today, Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, who come by pretty often, about once a month. And Lori is a physical therapist, athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Lori, great to have you back.
Great to be here on a day when the sun is out and it's warm and it actually feels like spring.
Yeah.
Totally.
And Jill is an associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. Great to have you back, too.
It's great to be here.
And, of course, if you have questions for these two, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. Or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. I'd love to hear from you. And before we even get started, a quick shout out to all the gang in Bayfield. We had a wonderful time on Friday at Bayfield in Bloom. Drove back and got a little rain driving back, but the people up there were just wonderful.
And the flowers were beautiful?
Flowers were beautiful, and they're going to be beautiful. Lupins should be coming on in about 2 or 3 days and up there, and it's going to be wonderful.
Nice. Good. Nice.
And then we came back to Madison.
Yes.
My birthday golf outing was 40 degrees, 39 degrees. It was one of those times where you really get a sprain or a strain.
Yeah, exactly, because you're cold.
Yes, and you're stiff and you don't move as well.
Right. You're kind of holding everything really tight to keep your body heat in.
My daughter had a lacrosse game on Saturday morning at 11 o'clock, and for part of it, it was actually sleeting.
Yeah.
But the girls, you could tell, even though most of them were dressed appropriately, you could tell they were holding their lacrosse sticks and their shoulders were shrugged and they were trying to stay warm. It was really cold.
Emily had a track meet, so she was the same.
Same thing.
Same thing. Yeah. Oh, well, anyway, there may be some new tools out there to help us when we get those aches and pains and sprains and strains from things like that. Are there some new ones out there?
There are some new tools out there, and then there are some old tools that have updated evidence. And so one of the things I think we wanted to talk a little bit about this morning was one of the newer tools out there, which is dry needling.
Yeah.
We've had lots of questions about that, and we've talked about it in the past. So the purpose of dry needling is to kind of break up that knot in your muscle. So you know how you get those trigger points in your muscles and you try and roll it out or massage it out and you just can't kind of break it up? Dry needling can do that. So a physical therapist can kind of piston or poke at that trigger point, kind of causing it to, for lack of a better term, explode and go away. And so that's one of the newer tools in physical therapist toolboxes. And here in the state of Wisconsin, physical therapists can dry needle. You can't in every state, but here in Wisconsin, we can.
So now, is that, you know, if I went to a masseuse and had them work on it, would I get the same result or would I?
You know, that's a great question. I think for some muscles that are very superficial, I think doing soft tissue mobilization works really, really well. I think the places where I feel anecdotally I've seen really good relief with dry needling are those muscles that are really deep. For example, your piriformis, which kind of lays under your gluteal muscles, and deep, deep, deep trigger points in your calf. So I think sometimes soft tissue mobilization just can't get to those.
Yeah, I'm sure there are a number of people out there who have done the tennis balls or the Yumi balls or those various things, trying to roll those spots. They get right on that spot and they sit on it and roll it back and forth and try to get at it. But as Jill said, if it's superficial, it tends to be a little easier to get at. But if it's really deep, it's just not enough pressure to make a difference.
And, you know, that's one of those terms. I think I hear dry needling, and I think, why isn't it wet needling? You know, I'm sticking a needle into somebody.
Well, it's not an injection needling.
Correct. And that's a great question.
Okay.
And actually, I think the whole history behind dry needling came about because there was questions when people received injections. Was it the medication that they were getting through the injection? For example, when you go to the doctor and they inject something, was it the medication Or was it the fact that there was a needle going in there and kind of causing some sort of change, some histochemical change? And so people started thinking, well, maybe it's not the fluid itself. Maybe it's actually the needle going and causing this reaction. So that was kind of how dry needling got started.
So what happens with dry needling? You're sticking needles.
Yep, you find the trigger point, and there's kind of well-defined maps of where trigger points have a tendency to lie in certain muscles. And I think I frighten my athletes because before I stick a needle in them, I get a book out. I say, does it make you nervous that I'm looking at a book before I stick this needle in your piriformis? But you want to know exactly where those trigger points lie. And so you do that, and then you put the needle in, and you kind of piston it or move it around. And then once you hit the trigger point, it actually creates what we call a twitch response, and it makes the muscle contract involuntarily. And so I'm not going to lie, it's not comfortable. It's a little uncomfortable, but a lot of people define it as startling because when you do hit that trigger point, the muscle contracts, and you're not quite prepared for that.
Yeah, I understand that.
Yeah, but then once you hit that trigger point and you kind of, as like I say, make it explode, people feel like the muscle is sore, like they've had a workout or exercise. And then what we recommend people do afterwards is to use the muscle. So if it's a lower extremity muscle, go for a walk, get on a bike, kind of flush it out. And by the next day, they feel a lot better. Yeah.
Very interesting.
It's fun.
Actually, Linda New Berlin has something relating to that. So let's just go there. Hi, Linda.
Hi, how are you today?
Great, appreciate the call.
Good. Hey, I just wanted to confirm what you're saying about dry needling. I've had some really tough knots in my shoulder and my neck, and they just really seem to give me a problem. They tried doing regular manual therapy on me, but what they do now is they do the trigger point dry needling in my upper shoulder and my neck. I've even had some TMJ problems, and they've tried it around there, too. But that's helped a little bit, but maybe not as dramatic as as just doing the shoulder and the neck. But what they do is they follow it up with manual therapy. Mm-hmm. After they do the dry needling, they follow it up with manual therapy and then just put that intense heat on there, and that really seems to loosen everything up. It's wonderful.
And then I'm guessing you follow this up at home with some specific exercises that also kind of help with this?
Yeah, like loosening up exercises, just really light loosening up exercises. I think the biggest thing I had to learn is that you have to tell people to sort of relax, you know, and not tense up when they're getting ready to get that dry needle, or else it's going to hurt a lot more. And that's what happened with me in the beginning. I'd be so nervous and I'd just be tensed up. I'm kind of high tone anyway. But if you just relax and work on relaxing and deep breathing and all that before the needle comes in, it makes it much easier.
That's a good point. Yeah. And I think the first time is always the hardest because it's that fear of the unknown. After you've had it done a couple times, it probably was easier to relax as well.
But she made a really good point that it's not a standalone intervention. You don't just get needled and walk back out the door. You get potentially some kind of intervention first, maybe a warm-up of some sort, something to relax. You get the needling, you get some manual therapy, and you get some exercise. So it's not something you just walk in, get dry needled, and 3 minutes later walk out the door.
Now, Linda mentioned heat, and that's, a question comes up. I've heard this one a lot. When do you use cold and when do you use heat?
Well, in the presence of an acute injury, i.e. I was playing basketball and I sprained my ankle or I twisted my knee, you use ice. Usually the first 24 hours, 24 to 48. Then thereafter, it becomes a judgment call based upon the intensity of the injury, the severity of the injury, and the time frame of healing.
Okay.
So acutely, ice. And then as sort of that broad statement, you can't ever really go wrong with ice.
Right.
Yeah.
But you can go wrong with heat.
Oh.
So if you're in doubt, ice.
Yeah.
For people who have arthritis and, it's a cold, wet, rainy day and they feel stiff and achy, heat usually feels best. And heat is perfectly fine in that case. In the presence of a relatively acute injury, you're better off with ice.
Right.
Thanks again, Linda, for calling. Appreciate it very much. Jerry in Shell Lake, your turn. Hi.
Hi, thank you. I have what I believe is self-diagnosed pinched nerve. I've dealt with it for 12 years, acute pain in the hip flexor, and then it goes all the way down to the ankle. and I can't put on my right shoe and sock. I can't touch my knee to my chin anymore. My left, no problem. My right, I can't. I sort of scream a little bit. Is there any exercise I can do to bring back my knee to my chin and be able to put my sock on and stuff?
So this has been 12 years you've been unable to do that?
Oh, no, no. Okay. been, 12 years ago, I sort of cured it with yoga.
Okay.
And I always keep it at bay with a lot of yoga. Now, actually, I'm a kind of a wild man, a lumberjack, a couple months a year, farmer, jogger, and biker. So maybe at 60 years old, I'm just, my spine is just falling apart. I don't know.
Okay. But what things bring on your pain? What kind of activities or movements?
Well, I can't run because you have to actually jerk your knee up into the air.
Okay. So it's lifting your knee forward?
Pardon me?
It's lifting your knee forward?
Forward and up towards my chin. Okay. It won't go.
And is it weak or is it painful to do because you have pain in your back or pain in your
body? Well, actually, there's no pain in my back. See, all this yoga, my shoulders, my small and my back are just wonderful.
Okay.
All right.
But, mm-hmm.
So I would suggest having this looked at. Typically, pinched nerves, if you had to make a generalization, tend to bother you into your buttocks and down the back of your leg. It's not terribly common to have it in front, especially with hip flexion. Usually, bringing your knee up relieves your pain if it's from a pinched nerve in your back. So yours is a different case. You know, if you told me, oh, you know, when I stand up and I bend backwards, I've got pain down the back of my leg, it'd be a fairly classic kind of presentation. Your presentation is different than the majority of people who come in with a classic pinched nerve coming out of their back. So I think you should go in and have somebody take a look at it. You have dealt with it very effectively, keeping yourself out of the medical system for 12 years. You're a very active right. young man yet. So I think having somebody take a look at it, examine your back, examine your hip, and find precisely the source of that pinched nerve, and they can direct you the right kinds of activities to do to relieve that.
There
right.
you go.
Now,
you
want to stay active.
Would I have a slipped disc if I don't have a backache at all?
You can. Some people have only sciatic without any back pain. But again, your presentation is not the typical one for most slipped discs that we see. And so I would want someone to take a look at you and give you the right kinds of exercises, because a slipped disc is not a slipped disc is not a slipped disc. Some people need extension. Some people need flexion. Some people need to stay in neutral. Some people need to stretch. Some people need to avoid stretching. It really depends upon what your exam looks like, which is why I'm reluctant to give you any specific activities that you should do or should avoid right now, except don't do the stuff that hurts.
Right.
So the exam would be an x-ray, and they would direct me to a
Not CT necessarily. Maybe? Not necessarily. You can get most of the information you need from your physical exam.
Right.
Mm-hmm. There we go.
So either you're a physical therapist. In the state of Wisconsin, we have direct access. You can see a physical therapist without a physician's referral. You just need to check with the clinic and make sure your insurance will cover that. And they can examine you and tell you whether or not they think you need an x-ray. And in the state of Wisconsin, physical therapists can now order x-rays.
Yep, that was a new thing that just got passed.
There we go.
So you could start there.
Right? Yep, good luck. Appreciate the call. Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, our guests today, as we take a look at physical therapy issues here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at 1 o'clock today, Kathleen Dunn will talk with a political analyst about the divisions inside the GOP and how the Sanders-Clinton race is shaping up, along with some other political news of the day. That's at 1. Right now, taking a look at physical therapy issues with Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. Jerome and Mequon up next with a question. Hi, Jerome. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm a senior citizen, and I'm calling about something which perhaps is prevalent in a lot of senior citizens. As I walk, I seem to crouch over, and it's getting worse all the time. Can you give me some advice as to what sort of therapy might take care of this?
So, Jerome, you mean when you're walking, your feet kind of cross over one another? Is that what you're referring to?
No, no. I crouch
bent over. Bent
over. Flexed. Bent over, right. Oh. And it's getting worse all the time.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, dovetailing off of Jerry's call previously, you know, many times as people get older and you get some stenosis in your back, you get some arthritis in your back, you tend to prefer a forward bent over position, which is why Jerry's presentation was unusual. The bent over position actually hurt him. And most older people, the bent position is more comfortable. What happens when you bend forward is you actually open up the spaces in your back where your nerve roots come out. So standing up straight and bending backwards become painful and limited. And because as we get older, we tend to sit more, sitting is also that bent forward position. So what we do for it is, first of all, examine you to see what the limits of your back range of motion are, and then whether or not we think we could accomplish getting you in a more upright position. So what we might do is stretch some of the soft tissues in the front, your hip flexors and thighs and things like that. Then we would strengthen some of the things in back that can actually hold you upright. We may need to do some manual therapy to see if we can loosen up your spine a little bit so that it's able to move in a more upright position. Another great place for you to work to accomplish that is in a pool, because so often the effects of gravity pull you forward. And in a pool with the unweighted of buoyancy, it helps you to be able to stay in a more upright position with less pain, so we can actually train you in that upright position. So those are some of the things that we would do.
Okay.
The other thing that's important for someone like Jerome, who does kind of walk with this flexed posture, if that indeed is the best place for him to be, is to assess him for risk of a fall, to make sure that he is not at falls risk. And if he needs an assistive device of some sort, such as a wheeled walker or something, that's something a physical therapist could provide him with as well.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. Dell and Mazamani up next. Hi, Dell.
Hi, good morning. I have a question about this needle. What's the difference between that needling and acupuncture, or are they just a different form of acupuncture? And I'll take your answer off there.
All right, thank you.
That's an excellent question. So dry needling and acupuncture are not the same thing. When a physical therapist performs dry needling, they are looking specifically for those trigger points in your muscle and looking to kind of hit those, if you will. Acupuncturists use meridians and acupuncture and acupressure points to treat conditions, and physical therapists are not trained in that. So it's very different. Our goal is to get the patient better, but we use a very different approach. And I think there's certainly patients who benefit from both.
All right. There we go. Thanks, Del, for calling. Chaz and Madison up next. Hi, Chaz.
Hey. Hi, I'm a newly massage therapist here in Madison and a former ballet dancer from Miami City Ballet. And I just wanted to know your thoughts about working with massage therapists, and if you feel like, do you refer to your patient out to other massage therapists, or do you work with a lot of them? That's just basically it.
Yeah.
That's a great question. Hi, Chaz. Well, as a physical therapist, I rely very heavily on my massage therapist colleagues. Massage therapists do an excellent job of finding trigger points, of, I think, applying the appropriate amount of pressure and type of massage for patients. And many times I refer my patients, should I get a massage? I say, yes, I do. And I have people in my back pocket who I recommend to. So absolutely, I think we can complement each other very, very well. And I think a massage therapy is indicated for lots of things.
Absolutely. And one of the things that massage therapists do that physical therapists don't always have time to do in their treatment time is actually put their hands really all over that patient. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes the massage therapist comes across things that the physical therapist possibly didn't detect because they were focused on a different part of the body. And the massage therapist may say, hey, look, I was doing the massage and I found this over here, you know, and so we definitely work together with the massage therapists.
Absolutely.
Chaz, thanks. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And more callers online. Number to call, by the way, 1-800-642-1234. Can also email us at talk@WPR.org or go ahead and post on our Facebook page title, The Larry Mueller Show. Now on to Pete in La Crosse. Hi, Pete.
Hi, Larry, Joe, and Lori. Every few years, I get back into weightlifting, and just so you know, I haven't broken or sprained anything yet.
Good.
I'm presently working with 10, 15, and 20-pound dumbbells, mostly upper body work like curls and military overhead presses, typically about twice a week when I get to it. So my question is, since I'm almost 60, what should my goals be, and does that old rule of no pain, no gain, does that still apply?
Oh, what a good question.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's good that you're staying with it. And I'm just going to put in a plug for weightlifting in older age. And our mother is sitting here with us in the studio. She took up weightlifting at 60 and called both Jill and I up and said how wonderful it is and why didn't we do it. I remember that phone call very clearly.
I do, too.
Yeah. So she still lifts weight. She's, can I say your age?
Sure.
81. 81. Going on 82. She still lifts weights 3 times a week. Yeah.
Yeah.
So big, big plug for it. You can continue to build strength throughout your older years, all through your older years. So do's and don'ts. First of all, it depends upon if you're a man or a woman. So I would look at those differently because of women's risk for osteoporosis. So I would have a different focus than I might for a man. But, you know, generally the dumbbells and free weights are best if you can do those because they require more balance and coordination than using a machine. Machines are safer. So for some people, the safety of the machine overrides the extra benefit of the free weights. And no pain, no gain. No pain in terms of muscle fatigue and muscle work, but that's a different pain than joint pain.
Right. Okay.
So as you get older, we, and I use that term, get joint pains. So you don't want to try to exercise through the joint pain, but you can certainly continue to exercise through the muscle pain, if that makes sense to you.
Yeah, I recommend that.
And additionally, working on power.
Right.
Strength, speed times weight.
Force.
Force times speed.
Force.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So lifting heavier weights more quickly for a limited number of repetitions, so including power. So I would work with a trainer who can supervise you and make sure you're doing things correctly.
And especially when Lori talks about power, I really like to use that in the lower extremity. We have a tendency to lose our strength proximally first, and we need our big glute muscles and our quad muscles to get up and down out of a chair, in and out of a car, go from sit to stand. So you do need a little bit of power for that. And so I would encourage you, as Lori said, to work with a trainer and work on some power in your lower extremity.
All right.
Okay.
There we go. Thanks a lot for calling.
Yeah. Good for him to keep lifting
him,
weights.
For
that's
sure.
Great.
Ray in Rhinelander has something for us. Hi, Ray.
Hi. Once again, you have really good people on this show. I'm in my mid-60s. I'm in a senior citizens program at the YMCA. We have a fantastic YMCA here in Rhinelander, Wisconsin. They have me on strength training and cardio. I work on 14 different strength training machines. I don't work out in the weight room, and you already commented on the strength training machines are safer. I've noticed they've covered a lot more muscle areas for me. I'm also on rowing, doing bikes, elliptical, and it's a fantastic program. Another thing I noticed, my heart rate went down on a more of an even scale by doing this. I have less stress. I sleep better, but I swear by those strength training machines. They're just amazing what they do. So have you heard about heart rate going down and stabilizing more with this also? And I'll take your comment off there, and thanks for this program.
No, thanks,
yes.
Ray.
Ray brings up a great point. People who are in overall better shape, cardiovascularly and strength training, ultimately what we do is we see our heart becomes much more efficient and our resting heart rate actually goes down.
Yeah, strength training, you know, people think of doing, you have to do cardio exercise to train your heart. Not true at all. Weightlifting is a different type of cardio exercise. So rather than the long, slow distance of the, you know, walking or riding your bike or whatever, it's more of the short-term, higher intensity. So it's a great balance to the other cardio work that he's doing. And there's a large body of research that shows that strength training has the same kind of impact on your cardiovascular system.
And it's one of the other things that we didn't talk about earlier that I just had an aha moment was sarcopenia, which is kind of loss of muscle mass as we age. And we used to think that this was just a normal part of aging, and it indeed is not. There was an amazing study that came out, and they looked at cross-sectional areas via MRI of people's thighs, and they took a 40-year-old marathoner, a 70-year-old marathoner, and a 70-year-old sedentary gentleman. And the muscle mass in the two marathoners, even though one was 70 years old, was identical.
And 40-year-old.
Yep, yeah. It was amazing, and looked completely different than the sedentary 70-year-old.
Yeah, yeah.
Don in Eau Claire has a comment for us. Hi, Don.
Hi. I'm not trying to pick a fight, but but I'm 93 and a quarter years old. Cognitively, I'm still in good shape, I think. I'm a retired physician, board internist, and I have learned to appreciate other forms of medicine other than the eclectic Western form of medicine. I've been a fan of acupuncture for a number of reasons. I'm not a diabetic, but I do have a severe axonal peripheral neuropathy of about 20 years. I went through a development of charcoal deformities in both feet, and on the right side, it led eventually to a BK amputation.
Wow.
I had pain in the right foot before the amputation, and of course, I got the usual answer to phantom pain. Some people have it, but it usually goes away. Well, after the surgery, some people have it, but it may never go away. Well, anyway, I do get relief of phantom pain, not total relief, but it does limit the frequency of episodes and the duration of episodes with traditional acupuncture. And my acupuncturist is well-trained, certified, went to an accepted school of acupuncture, and she was very upset, and I understand why, when physical therapists were all of a sudden given the right to needle people and with questionable training as to needling. It's if they think they're following meridian lines, that's probably not true. If they're just looking for trigger points and needling those, that's maybe something else.
Well, that's Don brings up a great point, and I will tell you personally, I've used an acupuncturist with good success as well. So,
and so have I.
And so has Lori. So I completely agree with Don. I think there are fabulous acupuncturists out there. We have lots of what I refer to as allied or fellow healthcare professionals that I refer to, and I refer to an acupuncturist as well. So I agree there's definitely a place for it. And I think Don brings up a really good point that I don't use meridians at all. I only treat musculoskeletal conditions. I only treat a trigger point that lies within a muscle. I don't treat any other conditions or diagnoses like Don is referring to. I would send that to an acupuncturist.
And I would say that the dry needling done in physical therapy is more closely aligned with trigger point injections that physicians do in terms of the indications for that intervention, much more than pain or the kinds of things that acupuncturists would treat. This is much more of a simple trigger point intervention in the absence of cortisone. Agreed. Yeah. So, but he brings up great points about acupuncture.
Yeah. Absolutely. What we, as Jill said, we've both had it in both. High five.
Yep. Successful outcomes.
Successful outcomes. Yep.
Thanks for calling, Don. Appreciate your call. Well, we have more callers online. 1-800-642-1234. The number to call. Kathy in Wausau up next. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. How are you doing today?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I have a question about my cousin. He's 50 years old, and he is a cyclist.
Okay.
And he likes to do the longer rides. He's not real famous or, you know, anything like that. This is just what he does to stay in shape. But the problem that he's been having over the last couple months is when he's done with a ride of maybe, I don't know, 20 miles, mm-hmm. something like that, he's getting numbness in his buttocks area and in the pelvic area.
Mm-hmm.
And it's numbness with some tingling.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what he did, of course, first thing, changed the bike seat, and that really didn't help too much. And it used to be where he would just have this numbness and tingling lasting for a day or two, but now it's kind of gotten longer. And he did have an MRI to see if there were any issues there, and that came through clear. But in the research, and I'm calling because he can't call during the day, but in the research he did, he indicated that there's something called a pudendal nerve,
mm-hmm.
and they were thinking that might be the problem.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he doesn't know where to go or what to do, how to approach this type of thing. It doesn't seem like a lot of people have heard of it, but there's so many cyclists that you'd think that this would be a more common type of problem.
Well, it's... I would say in male cyclists, we do have, it is a relatively common complaint. And it's funny you say 20 miles because most people you talk to say it comes on somewhere between 20 and 25 miles is where they start getting this numbness.
Mm-hmm.
However, typically once you get off your seat and you walk around for a little bit, it goes away. Both Lori and I looked at each other mm-hmm. when you said he had his numbness lasting 1 to 2 days. That's a long time.
Yeah. I would probably start with his primary. And I mean, obviously, he's been in the medical system because he's had an MRI. I'm not sure if what they looked at on the MRI, if it was looking at the soft tissue in the area or if it was looking at spine. So changing his bike seat is really only one step in the process.
Okay.
I would have him see somebody who is a professional bike fitter, at least here in Wausau. But I know here in Madison, we have physical therapists who are certified bike fitters. So I think having a physical therapist who's a bike fitter looking at it because of the symptoms that he's having, that's where I'd go next as the simplest thing. And if that's not resolving his problem, then I think going deeper into the medical system would be the right step.
Yeah, the handlebars might need to be raised an inch.
Right.
Or the change in the pitch of the seat.
Yep.
Sometimes that's all you need to, need to change. So, but like Lori said, a PT who understands the medical condition behind it and can fit you is probably a great way to go.
And you know, she said he changed his seat, and I don't know if he changed his seat height or if he changed the style saddle that he has, too. There's different style saddles that are designed specifically for this problem as well. Yeah. So there's a number of options out there for him yet, and I don't know what he's pursued this far. But seeing a PT who's certified as a bike fitter, and you can call clinics in the area and see if they have any physical therapy. Who's a bike fitter, and then you bring your bike in, they put you up on a trainer and off you go.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Yeah,
thanks
a lot for calling. If he's biking in the Wausau area, I don't know if you bike through there very much, but there's a lot of hills.
Yes.
Yeah.
A lot of hills.
Which may help him because he may be getting out of his saddle a little bit. So,
certainly got me out of the saddle. I'll tell you that. Man, oh man. Crystal in Foxborough, it's your turn. Hi, Crystal.
Hi. I have a question if physical therapy will help plantar fasciitis.
Oh, this is great. Our day's complete. We have a plantar fasciitis question. We love this question. Yes, physical therapists can help it. So the first thing is, why do you have it in one foot and not the other? Do you have it in both or one?
Just one foot.
Yeah, so that's the first question because... theoretically, your feet are doing the same thing all day long, walking, standing, etc. So why do you have it in one and not the other? So the first thing a physical therapist should do is do a stem to stern exam and see if you have a leg length difference, if you have a hip rotation, if you have a pelvic rotation that's causing asymmetrical loads on your feet. If you don't get to the cause of the problem, then the treatment to get rid of the problem will only be temporarily effective, and then your symptoms will come back. So the first thing is finding the cause. Then thereafter, treating the symptoms depends upon the exam, which is why we often tell you to see somebody. Are you flat-footed? Is your tibia internally, externally rotated? Is your heel in valgus or varus? You may need an arch support. You may need correction. It's your hip, because your hip is rotated one or the other. In terms of your symptoms, our very favorite intervention is the night splint. And you can get those online, and you wear those at night. Between 2 to 3 months, it usually takes care of the problem if you have fixed the underlying cause.
Exactly. So the reason the night splints are successful, or people like them, is because we have a tendency to sleep all night with our feet a little curled or our toes pointed, if you will. And what that does is that shortens your plantar fascia. So when you get out of bed in the morning and you take that first step, you immediately stretch it out after it's been shortened all night, and that can be quite painful. So sleeping with it in what we call a stretched out position, we like to call it creeping out the muscle or creeping out the tissue, will definitely help.
All right. Yeah, so I would start with a couple of visits to a physical therapist, have them examine you, see if they can figure out why you are having this problem, and then there's a number of different interventions they can use. You can come in orthotic, they can tape your arch, they can give you some rolling underneath your foot, the Yuma balls, some various things help.
So, and I think it's important that, you know, people say, well, you went to your physical therapist for plantar fasciitis and you got that exercise. I didn't get that exercise. I got this exercise, or they looked at my hip and not so much my foot. I think Lori brings up the point that you're kind of the plantar fascia is the victim, but why you have it, or what we as physical therapists call the contributing factors, can be anywhere from your foot all the way up to your back. And so that's why seeing a PT and seeing what for you specifically is contributing to your plantar fasciitis is really important.
There we go. Good luck. Thanks, Crystal, for calling. Appreciate your call. Taking a look at physical therapy issues today with Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. Lori with UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Jill, professor, associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer on the Ideas Network. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network as we visit with Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum about physical therapy issues, all those aches and pains and sprains and strains. I'm Larry Mueller, and we had a Julie on Facebook sent a note, says she has a piece of her medial meniscus removed a couple of weeks ago, starting PT this week. She's a distance runner, over 50. How long will it take to be able to run longer distances with ease?
So that's a great question. And my guess is she had her tear is probably degenerative in nature because she's a little bit older, which means she probably has some underlying arthritis in that knee to begin with. So, you know, it's hard to put a timeline on this because we don't know how big a piece of meniscus was removed. That will be a factor. How I explain it to patients is you basically have a pillow between your knee joint, and now we've removed part of the pillow, and so the rest of the pillow kind of has to learn how to adapt and take on more load. So there'll have to be some remodeling done with her knee. I'm guessing because she's a runner, she has good strength, which is definitely to her advantage. She would be probably the perfect person to start doing some nice cardiovascular rehab and running in the pool.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, this is one of these great questions where somebody comes in and says to me, well, my friend had knee surgery last spring, and she was recovered in a month. Why is it taking me so long?
Yeah.
And it's so hard to explain. Everybody's joint is different. You inherit your connective tissue from your parents. So how well her knee joint adapts to the change in loading pattern will dictate how quickly she'll recover from this. So as Jill said, you've got this pillow. The load is transferred from your foot up your shin bone across that pillow, then up into your thigh bone above it. Well, you've lost part of your load transmission pillow, so now the rest of the joint has to take more load. So how well your knee adapts to that will dictate how quickly she can get back. If her parents gave her, you know, $100 Pirelli joint surfaces, she could recover pretty quickly. If they gave her $10 retreads, it's going to take her a lot longer to remodel, and she's going to have to go slower. Her knee will tell her, pain, swelling.
Right.
There we go. Ann in Chippewa County up next with a question. Hi, Ann. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I have had, and I'm dealing with a variety of medical people with this condition, but they're calling it an orthostatic headache. As soon as I sit up in the morning, it starts with a pressure more than a pain behind my neck or behind my head and a stiffness in my neck. And as the day goes on and the more active I am, it progresses, like my whole head feels like pressure, including like sinus pressure and a stiff jaw sometimes, stronger pain in the temple area sometimes. And I'm just wondering if you have any ideas from a physical therapy point of view, anything that makes sense with that. It goes away every night when I lay down. But like I say, as soon as I sit up in the morning, it's back, and it has been every day since January.
So what brought it on in January? Any idea?
No, I mean, looking back, I'd had like a flu like the end of December, and then, you know, stayed home for a couple days, you know, just feeling like flu-like symptoms. And then later on, you know, I just realized after 3 weeks, thinking, man, I've had this headache and this stiff neck for 3 weeks, and actually went to the doctor thinking, do I have meningitis? And that wasn't the case. And there's really nothing in my sinuses, even though it feels like my sinuses are full. You know, even the top teeth having that achy feeling like when you do have a sinus infection. So
right.
It's obviously just nerves making me feel that way when there's nothing there. I mean, as an afterthought, I did fall sort of hard. I fell on the ice and just didn't hit my head, sort of fell hard on my rear. And I know it was in January, but I'm not sure if it was before or after the head.
Right, started. Right.
Mm-hmm. And you haven't had any imaging done, any x-rays or MRI or anything like that?
Yes, they've done CAT scan and MRI of my brain, x-rays of my neck, and MRIs of my spine. And actually what they started thinking was a cerebral spinal fluid leak, and one cisternogram showed some evidence of that, but then the next test that they did, a myelogram, was normal, so they're not sure if it's an intermittent leak, and, you know, they're still looking towards that as a diagnosis, but they're starting to sound like they're doubting that, so I'm just wondering if you have any ideas.
Wow. Have you had an angiogram?
No.
Looking for a Chiari? Have they mentioned that?
A Chiari malformation?
No, and I know what that is just from all the reading I've been doing about it.
Yeah.
They're saying that the MRI of my brain looks normal, and I'm assuming that that would have shown up on there or not.
Depends upon how they did the scan and
right.
what
angle
sequences they did and what they were looking for. So MRIs, that's a good point. MRIs are very specific to what you're looking for.
Okay.
So in terms of physical therapy, I can probably address that. You know, a physical therapist could examine you and see if you have any infrastructure that could be contributing to that. So what that means is I don't think that there's any primary problem here that has physical therapy written all
right.
over it. Physical therapy is not going to cure this. They need to figure out what it is. What physical therapy can do is look at the musculoskeletal system and your posture and see if there's anything there that's contributing to this that may take an edge off of the symptoms that could be secondary to this going on for this long. I think that's where a physical therapist might be able to help you.
Right. And typically if it's from a poor sleeping posture or something like that, as the day goes on, you would get
better.
And you're reporting just the opposite. As the day goes on, you get worse. So I don't feel like it's a sleeping position or a positional condition based on what you've said.
Right.
So, like Lori said, there may be a couple things that they could help you with, but I don't think that we could get to the source of symptoms.
They did at one point mention a cervical genic headache, and that's yeah. why they did the x-rays of
right.
my neck. And they, I mean, when I read the report, it sounds like they're saying all sorts of things are wrong with my neck, but the yeah. specialists are saying, well, no, that you know, sounds worse than it is, and I don't think that's causing
it. Yeah, well, okay. yeah, again, yeah. So it's something a physical therapist could look at you and you know, treat you as someone with a cervicogenic headache and see if it helps with your symptoms. Again, it may not deal with all of it, but it may take the edge off of
right.
it a bit.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah.
so good luck.
Right? Yeah. 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 Let us know how you turn out. Okay.
Yeah.
Call back.
Please call back next month.
Yeah. By, yeah that'd
in
be great.
A month, we should know. Yeah. So, and you guys are on June 20th.
Okay.
That's your next appearance. So, Ann, mark that on your calendar. Okay. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And Bev and Rhinelander up next. Hi, Bev.
Hi. I'm a 72-year-old female with rheumatoid arthritis, osteoarthritis, and osteoporosis. Are you there?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, we're listening. we're just writing it all down.
My problem started about 5 days ago. I woke up one morning, and I had a pain in my side. In the rib area, right about a little above the waist. And I thought, what the heck is this now? And as I got up out of bed and I started to walk, I thought, oh, it's pretty tender, and I was kind of bent over. And I walked around a little bit, and I got a little more limber as time went on, but I was a little bit concerned. And I bring my bird feeders in every morning because of the bears, and I decided I should get those bird feeders out because the birds would be hungry, and I went to reach up to hang the bird feeders up, and I got the most excruciating pain through my chest.
Yep. Yeah.
It yep. knocked me right to my knees. I'm
oh,
not
dear.
Kidding you.
Oh, dear.
And
so what did you do about that, Bev?
Well, I put my arms down after I quit crying.
yeah.
And eventually, I got my bird feeders up.
Of
I was
course you did.
But it hurt. Well, anyway, I went to the doctor. I was concerned.
Good.
And she did an EKG because she thought it was a heart attack, and it wasn't. And then I thought maybe it was broken ribs, and she prodded around, and she said no. So put me on a muscle relaxant. The pain on my side is still there, but I can raise my arms without that excruciating pain. The only thing I can think of that I did, Larry, you'll love this.
Oh, no.
I was conditioning my bales for my straw garden, and I lifted a 5-gallon bucket of water up to yeah. you know, put over the bale.
Sure, yeah. Yep.
And I don't know if that's what caused it. That's the only thing I can think that I did.
Well, Bev, are you getting better?
That's the question.
Are you getting better?
The muscle relaxant helps. I don't get that pain, but I experimented and didn't take it one night, and it was back.
Okay.
Okay. Well, that's... We don't encourage experimentation with medications, but you know, yeah. but you found out that it does make a difference if you take a medication, which tells us that there's probably muscle involved.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there are different muscles that that are in your rib cage that run between your ribs, and a bunch of muscles that attach to your ribs
okay.
that stabilize your shoulder blades. And so if you were lifting something heavy, all those muscles were working overtime to stabilize. Now, you did have a... What you
especially
a,
with a twist.
And a 5-gallon pail.
A 5-gallon pail of water.
You got to hold it out,
oh, yeah,
and
yeah.
it's awkward.
Yeah. Right. It's not
so,
like a little bird feeder.
So, you know, you had your x-ray that said it was negative. I'm wondering if you have a little stress fracture that didn't show up.
She did not do an x-ray.
She did not do an x-ray. She poked around.
She poked and prodded.
She poked around,
so,
and she said if your ribs were sore, it would hurt, and it didn't hurt when she did that.
Okay. All right. Well... In any case, if it were me, I would treat it as either a small stress-ish fracture or a stress reaction, possibly where the muscles attach there. So
basically, what you're doing is is making sure that you kind of keep your symptoms at bay. So keep using it as best as you can, but avoid those things that cause sharp, sudden pain. So it sounds like you're very active if you're dumping 5 gallons of water over a hay bale. I wouldn't do that now.
I would keep any loads, heavy loads, close to your body with both arms, but I would still try to stretch my arm overhead within a comfortable range. Not to sharp pain, as Jill says, but if you feel like pulling and tugging and a little bit of tension there, that's okay. So I would try to stretch it a little bit. You know, and if in another week you're still no better, I would go back.
There
you go. Good luck. Thank you very much. Yes. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Amanda's emailed to say she's 24, a distance runner. Her right knee has started to give her problems. Thinks it may be an IT band issue. Now her right hip gets a shooting pain whenever she puts pressure on it, especially when bending over. Any suggestions there on how to get rid of this?
Yeah, well, the IT man runs all the way from your hip to your knee. So starting thinking that that might have been the original kind of trigger is definitely a large possibility. It says she has pain in her right hip when she puts pressure on it, especially with, when bending over. So I'm not sure if that pain is in the front or in the back.
Yeah, it's not clear, but
she needs to see a PT.
She it could be the iliotibial band yet. When you step down, you tighten your glute muscles, and that tightens the iliotibial band over your right hip and down across your knee. So it's possible.
Could be that.
It's still the IT band.
Yep, she could have a little tightness in her hip capsule and getting a little bit of a pinch anteriorly that could be addressed by a physical therapist. She may have some asymmetries in her strength. If she has a little bit of weakness in her gluteus medius muscles, that would probably be the initial start to this cascade.
And if she's running on a slanted surface, that could account for why one leg and not the other.
Right.
So there are a number of factors that have to be sorted out. So I would see somebody and have them do, again, a stem to stern exam and figure out the cause of the problem.
There we go. Well, I tell you what, Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, our guests today. Lori, physical therapist and athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Jill, an associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. We'll take a look at the news and weather, and then we'll be back with our guests. Stay with us. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller, talking today with Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. Lori, a physical therapist, athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Jill, associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at the UW-Madison. Answering your questions about physical therapy and those kinds of achy and painful issues, join in at 800-642-1234. Or go to our Facebook page. You can post there at the Larry Mueller Show. That's the title of the page. Jane in Grafton up next. Thanks for waiting, Jane. Hi.
Hi. I had internal bleeding on my iliopsoas, and it's very weak and very, very painful. Is there anything I can do to strengthen that?
Is there a reason you had internal bleeding in your iliopsoas?
It came after hip surgery.
Oh. What kind of hip surgery, if we might ask briefly?
It was the recall of the first hip.
Oh.
It was the recall.
Of the components of the first hip. Was it a hip resurfacing that you had done?
No, it was a total hip.
Okay. So this is why it's more complicated and why we ask these questions. It's not just, we need to strengthen your iliopsoas. We're looking at two
major
surgeries.
Poor thing.
So strengthening iliopsoas. So are you having trouble picking your knee up? Okay.
Stairs are very, very difficult.
Is it the lifting your leg to the next stair, or is it getting yourself hoisted up to the next step?
Yes.
Okay. So you're really looking at everything. You're looking at not just the hip flexors, but you're looking at your glutes and quads.
Exactly.
So have they not sent you to physical therapy?
Yeah, I was in physical therapy for about a year.
But you're still not there.
I was okay for a while, but it's gotten real bad again.
Okay. Is it because of pain or weakness?
More so pain.
Okay. All right. So when we talked about starting our, when we started the show, we talked about terminology. And one of the things to talk about is exercise. There's what physical therapists do, we call therapeutic exercise, mm-hmm. as compared to exercise at the gym. So typically, if you think about exercise on a continuum, physical therapy is at one end of it, where we have specifically chosen, designed, tweaked, specified exercises for our patients' conditions based upon that examination. We continue to see that patient and progress those exercises as they get better, theoretically. And at some point, they cross the line from therapy or rehabilitative exercises to wellness. That doesn't mean that they are completely cured of whatever brought them in, but they are doing well enough to transition to a wellness program where they can be supervised by someone at a competent person at a gym or someplace like that. So my hope would be that when you finish physical therapy, They helped you bridge that gap to a wellness program, and it doesn't sound like you've had that because you've had this subsequent decline. So what I would say is you need to go back to physical therapy because you're having pain. You have a specific medical condition that needs an examination and specific treatments for these muscles, right. And hopefully, as they help you recover from this episode, that they will help you transition into a wellness program where you can maintain those gains you've made.
Absolutely. And research shows that people who have total hip replacements and total knee replacements need to do their exercises for the rest of their life.
Yeah.
So it needs to be kind of a way of life or a lifestyle. And we certainly wouldn't want to see this weakness on this side start affecting your other lower extremity.
Right. Or your knee on that side, correct. Or your back, because right. You change how you move, you can't get up the stairs, and so you change how you do it, and that overloads other joints, other parts of your body. Next, you come back with knee pain, back pain, hip pain on the other side.
Yeah, pretty much so.
Yeah. Okay, so is that something that will work for you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, well, give
it
a shot.
Awesome.
And
yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks very much for calling.
Yeah, good luck.
And Georgia in Glendale, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. It's George, not Georgia. But
sorry.
The reason I'm calling is my wife, who is in her mid-70s, has scoliosis, osteoporosis, and in her spine, and has been told she has to walk. And she is a walker. She is she would walk like 30 to 45 minutes for 5 days a week at least. Mm-hmm. Not a runner, she's going to see a personal trainer to do some balance exercises, some sitting exercises. But now for the past, I would guess, 4 to 6 weeks, she has had problems with the bottom of her feet. It's not plantar fasciitis, even though it may be developing into that because she's had it, but it's primarily with the bottom of her feet, like where the metatarsals are, the ball of the uh-huh. feet. And she's getting new orthotics.
Oh, great.
She's having laser treatment. She's having medical stimulation. She is in the process of finishing a methylprednisone 6-dose pack, if you know what that is.
Yep.
An anti-inflammatory.
Yep.
She's been resting it for at least a week, and there doesn't seem to be a lot of progress. She's still in real pain if she walks a half a block.
Wow.
So, any good suggestions?
So who has examined her feet to determine the cause?
She has seen a physical therapist. She has seen her orthopedist.
And what do they think is the cause of her pain?
That's a really good question. They say it's an inflammation. My guess is that about 3 or 4 months ago, she went to a podiatrist to have her nails trimmed, her toenails trimmed. And it appears that the podiatrist may have either clipped, damaged some way a nerve on her big toe. Hmm. And maybe somehow, my guess is, that spread to the other nerves at the bottom of her feet. And that's the only thing that we can do because she's been walking for years you know, because of the, you're supposed to have the tension, I guess, to keep
right.
To yeah. prevent
the bone. Right.
Yeah. So, you know, it almost sounds like neuropathy to me.
It does.
So, mm-hmm. is she diabetic?
No.
Okay. Well, you can still have peripheral neuropathy in the absence of diabetes.
Right.
So the things that she's doing, theoretically, if it was an inflammation, if she's finishing her dose pack,
right.
and she still is having this much pain, that would suggest to me that it's not inflammatory in nature.
Right.
And the orthotics she's getting.
Well, I think orthotics is a good idea
yeah.
because who's making her orthotics for her, George?
The same person who's doing the physical therapy.
Okay.
It's a place that sells good running shoes, but they have this person who's got more initials after his name.
Sure, okay.
Including a physical therapy. And,
great.
Yeah.
Okay. Great. So they all probably right. did a really good mechanical evaluation of her foot as well. And if she
right.
if she has something, they'll accommodate,
yeah,
should accommodate
like a Morton's
that
neuroma or something like that, that, you know. And, you know, with the scoliosis, you might think, well, you might have pain
load.
In one foot because of a leg length difference that needs to be accommodated. I would think that it was picked up either by the PT or the podiatrist, and a heel lift built in if that was part of the problem, and it would be probably one foot and not both feet. So the fact that it's both feet and it's not responding to that has suggests to me that it may not be inflammatory in nature. So
right.
I guess going back to her primary and...
So I think everything you're doing is right. And if you get the orthotics and you don't, and she starts walking and she feels like it's not changing, then I would definitely go back to your primary.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Try those yeah. out and see.
And in yep. the interim, she could walk in a pool where she's not full weight bearing and mm-hmm. see if she can do that so she can keep active.
The yep. other thing is a stationary bike. Could she do okay yeah. on a recumbent bike or a new step or something like that and see if it comes back or if
yeah.
she's okay with that?
Yeah.
Yeah. There we go. Good luck, George.
Great question.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Really interesting problem.
Yeah. Thank you so much for calling. I want to give John and Madison a chance to join us. John, hello.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
Okay, I tend to get tingling in my thumb, my index finger, and my middle finger. When I shave, I have to drop my arm down, and then it'll go away, and then I can continue, and then I have to repeat that. And talking on the phone, I have to switch hands because I get them in both, tingling in both hands. And I used to sleep on my back and on my side with a pillow, but now to relieve this tingling, I have to sleep on my back without a pillow, flat, or on my stomach. And it tends to be better if my face is turned to the right, vice turned to the left.
Hmm.
All right. Interesting. Yeah,
and,
sounds
and
like
riding
you're...
riding my bike and my motorcycle with my arms stretched out on the
yeah.
Handlebars.
Yeah.
It seems yep. to get a little tingly, and then I have to drop the hand down.
All right. We don't want you to do that while you're riding
yeah,
a motorcycle.
You're riding your motorcycle.
That sounds bad.
Yeah.
Hey, John, can I ask how old you are?
60.
Okay. All right. So... I think the problem is probably in your neck. So to have this in both hands, it sounds like it's the median nerve distribution. And my first thought was, oh, my goodness, I wonder if you have carpal tunnel syndrome. And you could, but it sounds to me like it's if you may have what's called a double crush and actually have a little pathology in your shoulder where you're getting, or excuse me, in your cervical spine where you're getting some impingement of nerve up there as well as in your hands.
Yeah. Yeah, you need to see somebody and take a look at that because you, when people have tingling in their fingers and hands, we look and we go, well, it could be coming from your wrist.
Mm-hmm.
It could be coming from your elbow. It could possibly be coming from your shoulder, although not very often, or it could be coming from your neck. And so we try to sort out, and through the from the information you've given us, it hasn't really helped us narrow it down too much.
Correct.
So it, you know, if I was a betting person, I'd bet on your neck.
Me too.
But it could possibly be impinged someplace else. Anytime you have symptoms on both sides, we look for a central cause.
Mm-hmm.
So it's possible you could have independent problems in both wrists, and many people have bilateral carpal tunnel. But my first bet would be it's coming from your neck, especially with the sleeping in the head position
right.
Deal. So I would get in and see somebody and get started on a rehab program.
Yep.
Find
Absolutely.
The cause of the problem and get going.
Get going.
Absolutely.
Good luck, John. Thanks. Shoshana in Milwaukee. Hello. Thank you for calling. We got there. Well, maybe we lost that person. Kathleen in Fifield. Hello.
Well, hello there, Larry. How are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good. How about you? What's wrong with you today?
Well, I'll tell you, John and I are close to being kindred spirits here.
Oh, no.
Yes, only the difference with me is that I have only the use of my right hand, and I'm having that tingling and numbness frequently, probably more often than not, although it's not real bad all the time, definitely overnight. 9 years ago, I had rotator cuff surgery on the right shoulder. 2 years ago, I dislocated that same shoulder.
Oh. Mm.
And actually, since then is when I've been experiencing this annoying sensation.
And where exactly is the sensation, Kathleen? Where in your hand?
Well, it's in the fingers.
Okay, all of them?
Yes.
Okay.
They're not, I mean, just, you know, not so bad that I can't use it or anything, obviously. But also in even sometimes in the the palm of the hand, and that's pretty much it. I just, like I said, I don't know if that would be. It's been since I dislocated the shoulder,
right? Yeah,
and even though I had had physical therapy for that. And I did mention some tingling at that time. Nothing was said about it or done about it. And it's only just continued and is
right.
Just,
mm-hmm.
It's time to go back and have them reexamine that to find out, you know, at the time of your dislocation, depends upon which way your shoulder dislocated, you could have damaged the brachial plexus either in the fall itself because you fall in an outstretched hand.
How did you dislocate?
Yes, it was.
Okay.
Yes, I fell forward and my arm was straight out.
Yeah, so you could have had damage from that fall itself or damage from the dislocation. It could have happened at your shoulder. It could have happened in your neck at that time. There are a number of possibilities, just as you said, with John and your kindred spirit. So, you know, they deal with the most critical thing first. You look at the dislocation. Same thing if you fall and fracture. They look at the fracture. They make sure the fracture's healed. And then the other things that that are secondary often get overlooked. So it's important to go back and have those things taken care of. If you stop and think about the magnitude of a fall that would cause either a dislocation or a fracture, it would be clear that you damaged other structures at the same time. It's not like it only damaged the bone or only damaged the joint. The muscles, the tendons, the nerve, the joint capsule, all those things are affected as well.
Okay.
So now it's time to go back and address that.
There we go. Good luck. Thank you for calling. And Steve in Danbury, your turn. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
A couple years ago, I had pain in my left elbow and a little bit above that, or I shouldn't say above that, below that in my forearm. Self-diagnosis here, I decided I had some kind of strain in my epicondyle tendon, so I bought one of those little Velcro bands, which I wore for about a month, and I tried to avoid using the arm, and it eventually got better. This spring, I've been doing a lot of concrete work, and this time it's on the right side.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm wearing the band again. It's not improving. It's not keeping me awake at night, but if I lift a cup of coffee or use a hammer, it's quite painful. I'm wondering if there are exercises that might help that, or am I past that point and at the point where I need to have it looked at or have an MRI? It's been ongoing for a couple weeks now.
Okay. Are you right or left-handed?
I'm right-handed.
You're a righty. Okay, and you're swinging a hammer, it sounds like, huh?
Yeah, from time to time.
Okay, all right. So I definitely think seeing a physical therapist would be helpful. You're not a lost cause, Steve. We were not going to put you out to pasture. I think a physical therapist could perform an evaluation and give you some exercises that you could do primarily at home, along with potentially some activity modifications and gripping modifications so you can continue to do your activity or help you modify your activity. You probably don't need an MRI or any imaging to start with. I think you could get by with seeing a physical therapist through direct access.
Steve, may I ask how old you are?
63.
Okay. So the physical therapy intervention tends to vary some across your lifespan because of the theoretical underlying etiology of the problem. So mm-hmm. if you were 24, we would probably treat this as an acute tendonitis, mm-hmm. so an actual itis inflammation. As you get towards your 50s and 60s, we tend to look at this more as a tendinopathy or a tendinosis, and that is a degeneration of the tendon. So the physical therapy intervention may vary based upon what they suspect the underlying cause is. They may start with the simplest things first, and they may not work. And then you may need to go to another sort of theoretical construct to treat this. So we usually tell people to hang in there and be patient as you work through this. It's also going to be difficult, as Jill said, because you're swinging a hammer. So the physical therapy exercises have to be structured in such a way that they don't overload you to the point where you can't do your work. And that is a very dicey exercise dosage issue. So, you know, exercise is not exercise. It has to be dosed properly, just like your medication has to be dosed properly. And when people are very active, the dosage becomes much harder to kind of fit in the physical therapy exercise that helps you get better, allows you to still do what you want to do, but doesn't overload you. So just be patient.
Is it common to completely tear that tendon?
Not terribly common, no. Mm-hmm.
Okay. No. Well, I appreciate your help.
Yeah.
Sure. Good luck. Good luck.
And Shoshana, do you have a quick question for us?
Hi there. Thank you for taking my phone call. I had a spinal fusion about 10 and a half years ago. I was 22. And I had had really limited to no problems up until, 6 months ago, and then 2 months ago, and now once again. And I had some x-rays done, and they had said I had some degeneration of my bones. I am trying to figure out how I can eliminate this pain and not keep it from coming back. And I'm not sure if I should do physical therapy or if I need to do exercising or...
Right.
Yeah.
So what level did you have fused?
L5S1.
Okay. Yeah, so what happens when you fuse two bones together is, unfortunately, the joint above and the joint below have a little bit more demand placed on them, and so a lot of people will start eventually kind of wearing and tearing down at those levels. So you're very young, and we want to keep your back healthy for a very long time, so I would definitely say seeing a physical therapist you'd be the perfect candidate for it, because they can give you instructions in exercises and activities that will help keep your back strong and stable so you don't end up with this kind of recurring situation. You had mentioned it's recurred like 3 times in the last 6 months with greater frequency.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So key things are to be to increase strength in your mm-hmm. core, as Jill suggested, and maintain a lot of mobility in your hips. And often what we need to do is look at how you move, how you lift, how you transition from one position to another, your resting posture, your moving posture, to see if there's something about how you move that's overloading mm-hmm. that segment. You know, for example, people who do twisting, if you twist excessively right above your fusion, you're going to wear out the next level. And what we see is progressive fusions from one level to the next.
Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. And boy, the time flew. Thank you guys so much.
Yeah.
Great listeners, Larry.
Awesome calls.
Awesome
today, as always.
And you're back on June 20th, and we'll do this all over again.
Sounds
Yahoo.
Great.
All right. Lori Tyne Brody, physical therapist, athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program. Great to have them along. They will be back on June 20th. Tomorrow we welcome author Erica Janik to talk about her new book that explores 175 years of lady detectives. Stay with us. Lots in store.